Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT podcast. This is the promised response to Paul Marek's very provocative lecture on fluids in the severely septic patient. So if you have not listened to that lecture, podcast 111, you will have no idea what I'm talking about. So you should immediately just go back and listen to that first. Because what I'm going to be doing is just kind of going through Paul's lecture, talking about what I agree with, what I disagree with, what's a little bit iffy, and then, hopefully, since this is supposed to be a flipped classroom, you guys will all respond with your own ideas in the comments. Though there has been already an insane number of comments in the original post, and if you haven't looked at those, you should go and look at those as well. And then Paul has asked me to mention that his slides for the actual lecture are on the page for podcast 111. So if you haven't seen those, go check those out before this response. So the first thing I'd like to mention is there's been a lot of comments saying this is a huge paradigm shift in the management of septic patients, and people's minds have been blown, and that's true. If you've grown up in your medical career recently, this seems like a paradigm shift. Me, on the other hand, I'm old enough to remember that this experiment has already been tried. They give the patient 500, 1,000 cc's of fluid and then put them on pressors to titrate their MAP. That's what we called standard care 15 years ago. When I was going through emergency medicine residency, this is how we managed patients. They would get a very small amount of fluid, and then they would get put on pressors. And one thing I know is those patients did not do as well as the patients we are taking care of now. Now, is that just because there's a different population of patients over the course of 15 years? I don't think so. So that's the first thing I really want to get across, is this is not a new idea. This is a throwback to an old idea, and an idea that I at least thought we had moved past, this low-volume strategy. Now, Paul is not advocating that same give 500 cc's and put them on dopamine, but it's not that far off. He's advocating give them 2 liters, or I should say, to be perfectly precise, 30 cc's per kg, and then put them on norepi. Well, that doesn't seem all that different from where we were. Now, the first thing Paul mentions is, should we be increasing the oxygen delivery at all? And oxygen delivery, it's essentially cardiac output and hemoglobin and arterial oxygen stat. And you put all those together, and that's how much oxygen is actually being delivered to your tissues. And now, he very accurately points out that in the past, when supranormal oxygen delivery was targeted, that was actually harmful and certainly not beneficial. And those were some of the original goal-directed therapy trials. We don't believe in doing that. We're not shooting for supernormal cardiac output. We're not shooting for supernormal oxygen delivery. And we're in entire agreement on that. That doesn't mean that shooting for normalization of oxygen delivery is also bad. You can't make that link. Now, Paul says that the patients that Rivers talked about in his early goal-directed therapy trial don't exist, that these patients don't have oxygen delivery issues, that you will not see central venous or mixed venous sats in the 50s. And I will tell you, you can see those patients. We do see those patients when we used to measure SCVO2. And I think it's a unique aspect of a poor, in our hospital, Janus General, predominantly immigrant population. They don't want to miss work. They don't want to come into the hospital, and they wait until they're at death's door before they'll come in the course of their septic illness. And we would see all the time SCVO2s in the 50s, the low 60s. Now, when you look at a trial like Jones's, Alan Jones, when he did the lactate trial, almost every patient in that was in pure vasodilatory shock, no elevated lactates. If they did an initial measurement of SCVO2, it probably wouldn't be super low. And it's a different patient population. And there definitely are patients who need a bolstering of their oxygen delivery. And depending on your environment, they might be an incredibly small minority, or they actually might be a significant portion of your patients. We see these patients at Janus General. So since Paul doesn't believe in increasing oxygen delivery, then what are his goals? Now, his goals are achieve adequate perfusion pressure, improve microcirculatory flow, and limit tissue edema, all of which I am thoroughly in support of. I'm just not sure how he plans on getting there. So let's talk about this. Now, he says the Rivers trial was essentially a waterfall. You are flooding these patients with fluid. And I don't really see it that way. I don't see where Rivers is telling you to give any large amounts of fluid you wouldn't otherwise. Let's think this through. What Rivers was actually telling you to do in the early goal-directed therapy trial was to resuscitate to a CVP of 8. Now, in some patients, that might be too much. If you have a super healthy heart, you're a young person, and you're slamming, you might just get to that 8 unnecessarily. But I think in most patients, the way 8 gets you off is that you actually probably needed more. CVP of 8 was not a patient who had maxed out on their fluid responsiveness. But the Rivers trial didn't tell you to resuscitate to a CVP of 8 and stop. And if that was all they did, then the Seven Mares trial that Paul published would have thoroughly debunked that. But that's not actually the way the protocol worked. The way the protocol worked was you resuscitate to a CVP of 8, or, you know, whatever, 12 if they're ventilated, but let's stick with the 8. And then you optimize their afterload. You increase their coronary perfusion, therefore. And then if they needed it, you would increase their hemoglobin. And if they needed it, you'd increase their inotropy. And then you'd look up at their CVP after each of those interventions. And if the CVP had dropped, you'd give more fluid. And you'd just keep doing that cyclically. You'd keep resuscitating to a CVP of 8. Now, I don't know if that works or not, but it's certainly not what was debunked in the Seven Mares trial, which is a single measurement of CVP at various time courses, not a cyclical resuscitation where you keep resuscitating the patient until you get a pressure that is somewhere midway between overloaded and underloaded is the guess. We don't know if it's true or not. And then you improve cardiac output, which is the major confounder of why CVP is such crap. So you do something to fix that, and then you look back up at the CVP and you give more fluids. This is different, and I just want you to bear this in mind. Why am I even talking about this? Am I advocating you start using CVP again? Absolutely not. I just want you to think about this. Keep this in your head, because this is going to become important in just a little bit as to why I'm saying that maybe the Rivers trial wasn't all that crazy in light of what Paul's going to actually tell you about in just a little bit. So remember what we're talking about here. We're resuscitating to CVP not as a static measure once, but instead as a dynamic cyclical resuscitation. We're going to do other stuff that may affect the heart, and then we're going to go back, look at it again, and potentially give more fluid. This is not all that different from what I do with my IVC ultrasound, in that I resuscitate until there's not any significant collapse. I do a whole bunch of other stuff, and then I will go back and look at the IVC again. And if it starts all of a sudden collapsing with significant degrees of wall nearness, I will give more fluid. So that's similar. So let's just keep that in the back of our head. All right, in the next part of the lecture, we move on to MAP and its association with survival. And Paul demonstrates a study saying that in patients who you can't maintain MAP, they don't do so well. And I believe that to be true. But that's not really saying anything about fluid. It's not saying how we got to the MAP we want. It's not saying whether we should restrict or give the patient more volume. It's not saying that at all. Now, since we know we want a certain MAP, and I agree with Paul in this regard, and I don't know what that exact number is, but it's probably hovering somewhere between 55 and 65 in most patients, and let's just use 65 for ease of remembrance. How do you get to that 65? Well, there's essentially two ways at the extremes that you could do it. You could just purely vasoconstrict in pretty much empty vascular system, in which case you'll get your MAP. You won't get a whole lot of flow. You won't get a whole lot of blood actually circulating to the tissues, to the end organs. Or you could just give an insane amount of fluid to match the incredibly vasodilated vasculature of a severely septic patient or a septic shock patient. And that would probably be bad as well, especially if you believe, Paul, that that fluid's all going into the interstitium. And now you just have to basically be hooking a garden hose up to the patient's IV to make up for the loss of fluid and the massive vasodilation. Well, that doesn't seem good either. But the question is there a middle ground where you get both of those conspiring to give you a normalized vascular tone and a normalized volume in that vasculature? Though that would make a lot of sense to me as what I want. And that would give me an optimization of the patient's flow to their end organs and to their microcirculation. And I don't really know if just putting them on pressors is doing that. And I would guess it's probably not. And we'll talk a little bit more about why I think that is in just a bit. But let's get to the glycocalyx so we can get it out of the way. Now, this was a part of the lecture that some of the readers wrote in and say, why are we even listening to this on an MCRIT podcast? This has nothing to do with anything we care about. And I got to tell you, you're going to be hearing more and more about the glycocalyx. It's super important, and it will become more and more clinically relevant. So just bear that in mind. That's why Paul went over it. That's why I'm going to spend a little bit of time here. And that's why I think you should all check out the video I put in the show notes. Chris Nixon turned me on to this. It's by a gentleman named Rob Wise, and it's 5 minutes that explains what the glycocalyx is. And boredom is always stems from a lack of true understanding, in my mind. If you understand anything well enough and you really get the intricacies, there's really not anything to be bored about. So if the glycocalyx seems boring, it's probably because we don't understand it enough. So watch this video, and this stuff might get more interesting. Now, Paul tells us that the fluids we're giving actually have the potential to damage the glycocalyx, that hypervolemia is a potential risk to the glycocalyx. I don't know how to really put this into clinical terms. Now, one of the things mentioned was that it's the natriuretic peptides, the atrial and BNP, that are actually the root of why the glycocalyx starts to leak in the setting of too much volume resuscitation. He also tells us that a majority of the fluid is in the venous side. Now, and this is blasphemy, and I don't really mean this. I don't want you to take this home as a clinical message, but if that was really true, if the real problem was that we were overfilling the heart and therefore it's secreting these hormones, well, then you'd probably want some kind of monitor to tell you that the pressure, because that's what's causing the release of ANP and BNP, is atrial and ventricular pressure. You'd probably want a monitor that would actually tell you that that pressure is not too high. You'd probably want to use it as a barrier to over-resuscitating to make sure there was some pressure limit on how much fluid you gave at any period of time. And if that pressure in those cardiac chambers got too high, you'd probably want to stop your fluid temporarily. We kind of have a monitor for that. It's called the CVP, especially if you believe that most of the fluid we're dealing with is in the venous side and then the right heart, which the CVP is actually not a horrible measure of. That would be looking at it and would be kind of our cutoff valve to make sure that we're not getting the secretion of ANP and BNP. We'd actually monitor the CVP to make sure the right atria, the right ventricle is not getting overfilled. I don't want you to do that. Now, at this point, I need to make it abundantly clear. I am not advocating for this as a strategy. This is a really stupid idea. I don't think it would even work. I'm just saying, as a thought experiment, think this through. Do not start using CVP as a monitor to save the glycocalyx. Please don't do that. But if we really believe that ANP, BNP is the problem, that would kind of make some sense. The literature I've seen in the trauma world, I haven't seen this in the septic studies, and I haven't seen this in Paul's study, but in the trauma world, at least, it seems glycocalyx is injured by unbalanced solutions, by the acidic solutions like normal saline. They might be a problem, and that maybe the balanced solutions are the problem. Maybe Paul's entire set of studies he's showing us is because most of the medical resuscitations, the sepsis resuscitations, are receiving things like normal saline. Maybe that's where all this is coming from. I don't know. I don't know what to do with this glycocalyx. But here's what I do know. Really sick septic patients get sepsis-induced cardiomyopathy. Their hearts start failing, even if they had good, healthy hearts before their septic course. I also know when you have sepsis-induced cardiomyopathy, when you have cardiac stunning, when you have all these problems, your BNP goes up. That's known. And if BNP going up is associated with all sorts of problems and it's associated with death, that might just be purely an association from how sick the patient is. And that's going to be a recurring theme in this entire talk, is associations don't necessarily mean causation. We have a name for this logical fallacy. It's post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy, meaning just because something happened afterwards doesn't mean it happened because of. And we're gonna really be zoning in on that particular logical fallacy, because I think it's the way we counter most of these studies. We then get to a very interesting part of the lecture. Do crystalloids stick around? Now, a rat study was put up, and I don't know what to do with rat studies, but I couldn't really understand what to do with this study, except to say that maybe we should be using more albumin in sepsis. That's all I could really take away from it. But Paul's statement that 100% of crystalloids disappear into the interstitium in a certain number of hours does not make physiologic sense to me. You wouldn't stay alive if that was really the case, to my mind. And that brings up the next point, which is the point about the marshmallow people of severe inflammatory states. And if you've spent any amount of time in the critical care unit, you all have seen this phenomenon, which is the really sick patients get more and more edematous, and then they just stick at that point for a while. And then if they start getting better, they start mobilizing fluid. And if you miss that, you screw them up real bad because then they get volume overloaded at the point at which they're getting better. But you have to start diuresing these guys. You have to start helping their kidneys take off that water. And I honestly don't know how much of that is really related to the fluid we give. I think you could probably try to volume restrict these people who have these severe inflammatory states, and you might get away with it for a while. You might be able to temper it with much higher doses of vasopressors than you ordinarily have to use. And then eventually they get to the point where either you give them fluid or they die, where their IVC is collapsing entirely, their left ventricular chambers are touching each other, you know, the walls of the left ventricle. And eventually you say to yourself, maybe we should give some fluid, and you do. And they're gonna put that into their interstitium. And then you might hold off again, and eventually you're gonna give more. Eventually you're going to give these guys fluid. And I honestly don't know what the difference in the amount of fluid you're gonna give when you just try to keep them dry versus keeping them wet. I just don't think there's going to be an enormous difference, and that I think these guys are going to get to be marshmallows whether you like it or not. It's just the nature of their inflammatory state that if they're not putting into their interstitium what you give them, they're going to put into their interstitium what's already there sitting in their plasma volume. You're not going to be able to prevent it. And this is just my bedside observation, and I'd love to hear from other intensivists on the podcast, but that's just my thoughts. Now, if it really is true what Paul's saying, that 100% of your crystalloid disappears, my belief is that is up until a point, that they're probably in a new state where they want to get equilibrium, but the equilibrium is them being really puffy, them really having a bunch of fluid in their interstitium. And if they do extravasate into their interstitium 100% of that fluid, that at some point that doesn't happen to this 100% extent. And eventually they achieve some kind of new sick person homeostasis where there's a lot of fluid in their interstitium, but they're also holding on to a lot more of it in their vasculature. So that's all I could really say about this. I haven't seen any great evidence on either way, and it's certainly not going to be the rat study that convinces me. And now we get to the part in the lecture where the post hoc ergopropter hoc fallacy really, really plays a huge role, because we talk about a lot of clinical studies proving fluid increases mortality. And I didn't see any of these as demonstrating that to me in any way. It tells me that maybe fluid is associated with mortality. I don't even believe that from these studies. So let's go through this. Here's the stuff that I need you to evaluate. Many statements were made about positive fluid balance being associated with increased mortality. And that very well may be the case. I truly believe that's the case. But positive fluid balance does not equal extra fluid administration. It doesn't do that by a long shot. As these patients get really sick, their kidneys don't function so well. They don't pee so much. And they're going to be positive on their fluid balance no matter what. And you could try your best to keep them negative. And just like I said about the marshmallow people, eventually you're going to give them a little fluid. Eventually these patients are going to have a positive fluid balance. And I don't think it's because of an excess of fluid. I think it's just because they're holding on to whatever they get and they're not peeing it out. And this is what I see on sick patients all the time, is their fluid balance is positive during the initial phases of their illness. And if you try to get their fluid balance negative, you're gonna fail. You're gonna fail. This is just how it is. I mean, I'm rotating on the units right now, and I just see this every day, is in sick patients, getting a negative fluid balance is damn near impossible. And the reason they die is because they're sick. Now, the really ironic portion of the talk was when Paul put up a slide saying that high CVP is associated with increased mortality, and therefore that means that we gave them too much fluid to get the high CVP, and that's associated with mortality. Paul is better than anyone in the world, the debunker of CVP as a marker of volume status. So you can't have it both ways, Paul. You can't say that CVP has no use, has no predictive value for how much fluid the patient needs, and then go on to say that a high CVP means the patient got too much fluid and therefore that's associated with mortality. The reason your CVP being high may be associated with mortality is because if your heart's not working, that's associated with mortality. If you have sepsis-induced cardiomyopathy, that's associated with mortality. That gives you a high CVP. If you're on super high vent settings, your CVP is going to be high. That also doesn't work out so well for a lot of patients. Now, in one of the trials Paul mentioned, and I believe it's the reanalysis of the VAST trial, the best survival was the 3 liters positive fluid balance at the 12-hour mark, which I actually think is not a bad place to be. Let's go on to the FEAST trial, because this is super interesting. For anyone who doesn't know, FEAST was a super impressive trial because it was done in really tough circumstances in Africa and places that trials are not normally done, really sick kitties, a bunch of them with malaria, all of them with sepsis, and it was a randomized controlled trial of giving these kids either normal saline or albumin versus no fluid resuscitation. And to the surprise of the study authors, when they were doing the trial, it turned out that the kids who got more fluid did worse. And we had a struggle to find explanations for this, but there is an article that doesn't get talked about much, which is the reanalysis of the FEAST trial by the original authors. And I link to that in the show notes. And the authors believe these kids were going to be dying of either neurological failure or pulmonary failure. Either they get cerebral edema because malaria with fluid may cause that, or they get pulmonary compromise because they flood their lungs. But it turns out that's not why kids died with any degree of alacrity. The reason they died was cardiovascular collapse, which tells us the fluid obviously was the root of why these kids were dying, but not in the way that we would think, not in the fluid overload sense. So when the authors were struggling to figure out why these kids died, what they came up with a few things, but the most prevalent amongst them is, did we cause already profoundly acidotic kids to become more acidotic? Because the fluid we gave them was normal saline or albumin, which has an unbalanced fluid carrier. It's essentially normal saline plus the albumin molecule. So that's what they came up with, and this doesn't get spoken about. I suggest you look at that trial reanalysis and see what you think. But kids were not dying because they were flooding their lungs, and they weren't dying because their brains were getting flooded. Now, at this point, Paul shows the Marek-Philip curves, which are super cool, and it's just superimposing a lung water curve on top of these Starling curves. And from my looking at these curves, what it seems like is these patients do not start filling up their lungs until they hit the flat portion of the Starling curve, which would mean to me that if you're using a fluid responsiveness strategy to figure out if you're going to give the patient more fluid, then you're not really at risk for extra vascular lung water, at least based on these curves. So this is an argument to not give fluid blindly, but to use a fluid responsiveness strategy. Now, as to why I mentioned that, you'll just have to wait a bit till we get to Paul's protocol. But Paul's protocol doesn't really push for a fluid responsiveness strategy, but his curves would say that that probably is a good idea, at least to my mind. All right, the last thing to talk about is one thing that Paul and I absolutely agree on, which is that the initial response of vasopressors like norepi, beginning at their dose range, even before they have much in the way of afterload effects, is to actually tense the venous side, to actually increase the stress volume and actually increase preload and therefore cardiac output without its actual inotropic response and without affecting afterload necessarily. And this may lead us to an earlier pressor utilization than we have before. And I put a whole bunch of articles in the show notes on this. It's something I plan to discuss on the vasopressor show. It's something John Myberg discussed at SMAC, but this is good stuff. But what we know is not good stuff is unduly increasing afterload, because that actually will stave off cardiac output. It'll actually make the patient's perfusion worse if you take them too far on the afterload and actually decrease the ability of the heart to pump. So it's a careful balance you need to seek. And if you go too far on your norepi, you might make things worse. The best trial of the three is the one published in 2013 by Moss. That's on the bottom of the list of articles. It's also at the CME site. You can find that article there. But that is the one to look at if you really want to understand these responses. And from that article, at least, low doses of norepi will get you this preload augmentation, this stress volume response. So now we're finally getting to Paul's algorithm. And the problem I have with Paul's algorithm, first of all, is it tells you to give a little fluid, you know, give your 30 cc per kg bolus, give your 2 liter bolus, and then immediately just put them on norepi, but take them all the way up on the dose range of norepi to something like 14 micrograms in your average size patient before you even ask yourself, well, are they still fluid responsive? And there's really nothing in terms of endpoints there. Now, Paul mentioned that we want to perfuse the microcirculation, but we're not really monitoring the microcirculation. And that lack of endpoint is somewhat concerning to me. Now, here's the point where we'll discuss Paul's trashing of lactate and lactate clearance. And this was previously addressed in a we. The stuff Paul says is absolutely true. We've known forever that what you're seeing with lactate, a majority of it is not from anaerobic metabolism in the cells. It's not from the cells not receiving enough oxygen, this dysoxia. A lot of it is just from the hormonal surge, the stress response, the surge response, upregulating your lactate production, aerobic lactate metabolism. But this is kind of a straw man argument because we've never said it's solely a result of anaerobic metabolism. What we've said is when your lactate is high, that's associated with you dying. And when your lactate can be cleared, those patients die less often. This is not just the sepsis literature, this is the trauma literature as well, and I think in a bunch of other sick conditions as well. Lactate high equals death association. Lactate low equals not so much death. Lactate being brought from high to low equals better survival association. And again, none of this stuff is causative, but this is, at least in my mind, why a lactate clearance strategy is worth doing. What I want is some form of tested microcirculation monitor, and there's a few of them out there. I don't know if they've really borne out in sepsis yet. The Theonar Eminence one failed, unfortunately. Sublingual capnometry looks like it has some potential. It works in trauma patients. I know a few people looked at that in a while ago. It didn't really pan out, but we need something, maybe near something, to tell us microcirculatory goals. When I see the lactate going down, it's probably a good thing. I don't think the 10% is really where we're going to leave off at. I think probably clearing fully is what we should be shooting for. When the Jones trial was reanalyzed, that was actually what bore out the best results, is a patient to fully clear their lactate. That's probably what we should be shooting for. I don't like sticking in these catheters, but intermittent SCVO2 seems to make sense when it's low to get it to above 70. When it's above 70, we don't really know what's going on. We need something better. But the lack of any endpoints is a little worrisome. Now, I think the way Paul would justify it is that if you fix all the stuff you could fix, it doesn't really matter if there's an endpoint. There's nothing more you could do. And his protocol embraces all that. He has areas for assessing the heart with echocardiography and adding in inotropes, for eventually reassessing further fluid responsiveness. But my alteration of Paul's algorithm is thus. I would say you just give 2 liters of fluid right off the bat. Then you should take a look at their heart and take a look at their IVC and get a general gestalt and decide whether you want to give an additional 1 or 2 liters. So now you're, let's say you're at the 3 liter mark. At this point, if you think the patient needs more fluid, you probably shouldn't give them more fluid. You probably should put them on a modicum of vasopressor. Maybe, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 5 micrograms of norepi before you do additional testing of fluid responsiveness. And at that point, you probably should use a real monitor, something that generates stroke volume, and use that along with passive leg raise or fluid challenge to determine if they need more after they've gotten the norepi on. And then if after all that and they're no longer fluid responsive, they're still borderline blood pressure, well, then you add in more norepi to actually get your afterload response. So I stuck that in the show notes as well. So to sum it all up, the pure experiment of give a piddling amount of fluid and then put them on vasopressors has been done, and that was a failure. That was sepsis care 20 years ago. Paul himself sent me an article showing that in all sorts of trials, when you look at the control arm, sepsis mortality has been dropping over the past 20 years. And I absolutely believe it. It's what's borne out by our sepsis collaborative. You don't need to do much for these patients. You need to give them a modicum of fluid early on. You need to care about them. You need to give them early antibiotics, and you need to put them in a place where people watch them. And if you do that, you're probably getting 99.9% of the mortality benefit. And all the other stuff we argue about is all bullshit. But I think there is something to not giving the patient a ton of fluids until you tense their tank a little bit, maybe with a low dose of norepinephrine. I think we probably should not be doing empiric fluid loading if we could avoid it. We probably should be using some form of validated monitoring technology. And I'm a little bit more liberal than Paul in the first 12 hours of resuscitation, but I am absolutely as stingy as him once those 12 hours are gone. And I think the difference between my more liberal strategy and Paul's stingy one is probably on the order of 1 to 2 liters. And Paul, I just can't imagine that I'm killing my patients with that, no matter how many associations we perpetrate. So to end it all up, I think we're on the same page. And if I'm not, I'm sure, absolutely positive, Paul's going to tell me. But I want you folks to tell me too. So put what you think in the comments. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.